Farm now with Bob Drake, who has been artist in resident all week at Wave Farm, working on. Well, you've been failing at. What have you been failing at working on?
I've been failing at almost everything. What a wonderful opportunity! What a great place. Yeah, I came here to do a project related to radio and controlling radios with movement. So,
and you came from Cleveland?
From Cleveland, Ohio. Home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is kind of sad. But anyway, I had a
noise for that? Let's see.
No. The sad noise? Sad trombone noise? Any of those. They're all good. But yeah, so I had this scheme where we would have dancers and a 3D camera that could track their motions and use that to control a radio, a software defined radio, which is a new technology that I've been playing around with. And the cameras didn't work, and all of the libraries and the software that I have used in the past are deprecated, and the people who wrote them don't support them anymore, and the computer didn't work. And so then I had to come up with an alternate plan, and then the software-defined radio didn't work, and had to put up a new antenna, and got that working. But I haven't gotten to talk to each other yet.
There wasn't all failure.
Well, it's all...
And the failure was also the success.
There's nothing wrong with failure. Probably my favorite thing is failing, because if I'm doing the same thing that I know how to do, then I don't fail, but I don't learn anything. And it's kind of boring. I'm an adrenaline junkie. I like learning new stuff all the time. It's been just been a really open and inviting place to try stuff out and figure out what doesn't work and then bang your head on it a lot, which is fine.
Have you done many residencies before?
No, this is the first time I've actually had a formal space, and it freaked me out a little bit at first. I'm not sure what I expected, but I was standing around in the middle of the room on about the second day saying, I can do whatever I want, apparently. Well, what do you want to do? And so, you know, it was helpful to have this plan of things that I aimed for. And then when those didn't quite pan out, then I had to come up with new stuff, which I did, which was fun. So...
people are just tuning in and introduced to Bob Drake. What would you say you are, a sound artist or a musician or a tinkerer or what nouns do you like?
Yeah, sure. All those things. One of the things that I am recently is a teacher. I actually get to teach sound art and electronics at Cleveland Institute of Art as an adjunct. I did not quit my day job, so I don't have the adjunct blues. But what a great opportunity that is! I just love working with students and kind of feeding off their curiosity. And it's an interesting situation because it's part of the sculpture department, and so.
They consider sound to be sculpture.
Well, they kind of shoehorned it in there. One of the props there had been at Buffalo with Tony Conrad and had an interest in kind of new media stuff. And it was another failure and another mistake. Somebody else was supposed to teach this electronics class, and they bailed it with 2 weeks' notice, and they said, oh, he knows art and he knows electronics. Maybe he could do it. So I pulled that out of my hat and kind of got a foot in the door. But when I talk about sound there, it's to visual artists and people who are used to working with their hands. And so I'm talking about sound as kind of a plastic material and kind of forming that in space, in working rather than time, which is what you normally think of as music, or I normally think of as music as it takes place, you know, it has development and, you know, there's one things. And whereas sound art really takes place in a spatial, you know, it's an installation or the sounds are sitting there. We do a lot of stuff with standing waves, and a lot of stuff looks like physics experiments, actually. But it's a different way of approaching sound, because they're not expecting it to mean something or carry some kind of emotional baggage with it. So try to get them to encourage them to experience it just as sound per se, you know, which lots of people have done over the past 50 years in particular. It's nice. It just opens up things for them in a different way. And it's so circuitously back to your question, are a sound artist or a musician? It's kind of both. I play guitar and I can play songs if I want to. But what interests me more is the sounds themselves rather than telling a story.
Do you have any favorite sounds? We often ask this question.
Favorite sounds. I love water sounds. I love sounds of thunder and thunderstorms. I did a project a couple years ago, the 17-year cicadas, which appear in different areas, different years, appeared in northeastern Ohio, actually eastern Ohio, a couple years ago, and I spent about 2 months sitting in fields listening to cicadas. It was the most awe-inspiring experience I've ever had. They were amazing. Just billions of insects trying to get laid, and screaming at the top of their voices, "Pick me!" You
know. Now, aren't those two different? Exactly the opposite sounds. Like you said, water sounds first, and that's like liquid and like melding into each other, and like the cicadas are like a real Z buzzsaw, like
like triangle wave.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like isn't that kind of the opposite from a sonic point of view?
I like opposites.
So do you want to mix those two together? Did you want to have a rainy night because they don't make that noise when it rains, do they?
They're anxious. They've waited 17 years for this, and they've only got about a month before they die. They're going to sing their hearts out. Yeah, I like all kinds of things. But the tagline for my radio show, which was called Crap's Last Tape, was all kinds of music for all kinds of folks. It was supposed to be a folk music show, but after about 3 weeks, I got bored with just playing Leo Kottke and started playing Albert Eiler in between, and kind of went downhill from there. But I like Harsh Noise Wall, and I like Wandelweiser, minimalist stuff. I'm glad I don't have to choose.
Cleveland kind of has a reputation for some of that?
Cleveland has a wonderful storied history of failure. Folks who tried to make it and didn't. There's a new five record set of Peter Loeffner just came out, who was in the prototype for Pere Ubu, which is the best band ever that never made it. And Cleveland in general has this wonderful, terrible self-image. Like we'll be standing around at a show and say, "Oh, if this was New York, there'd be 100 people here. You know, there's only 12 people, you know, at this show." And I'm like, "I've been to New York. There's only 12 people at that show too." But they're not standing around beating themselves up because it's not that good, you know. So because Cleveland thinks, "Oh, I'm never going to make it," it kind of gives folks this freedom to do whatever the hell they want, because they're not going to make it anyway. So, you know, why hire a publicist? You can just do what you want to do.
Is there less New York envy? Like, I grew up in Baltimore, and we like hated New York because
we don't care about New York.
Exactly.
Yeah, we don't care. We don't care about LA either. You know, just like that. Like I said, we got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because we stuffed the ballot box. That's how that happened. But, So Pere Ubu was the connection. So in college, I studied some electronic music along with ethnomusicology and some other stuff, and then went away from that for about 15 years. And then I saw Pere Ubu playing at one of their reunion shows, and there was Alan Ravenstein playing his EML synthesizer. And I was like, oh, that's what I used to play in classes. Boy, I wish I could get one of those. And so I went on eBay, and they were like $4,000. I said, I can't afford that. I'll build one. So I learned a bunch of electronics and built this huge analog synthesizer before they were kind of commercially available. And I would have saved a lot of money if I had just spent the $4,000 up front. But I learned a bunch of stuff. And also failed a lot. I had big piles of circuit boards that don't work. Sad pile of projects that need fixed. I kind of poke at them every once in a while, and they still don't work. It's great.
So what have you been poking at here?
So
we were going to talk about radio first, I think, weren't we?
Yeah, we were going to talk about that. So the proposed project was a combination of a scheme to hijack a Xbox game controller, which has the ability to visually track people in its path, which is how when you're fighting or dancing or whatever you're doing, playing your game.
Dance fighting,
right, which I love. You know, so it can track that, and those have been hacked and exposed to experimenters. So there's a way to connect that and extract skeleton data of, you know, where your hands and arms are. I'm waving my hands and arms as I'm saying this. You can't see that.
If they stare to the left into the speaker, they might see it.
Okay, yeah, it's on the left hand. So you
have to have the special box to get the that feed.
Yeah.
Don't tell them about that.
I'm working on that. That's next.
You have to send in 18 cereal box tops to get that.
I want that. Anyway, so I'm trying to hack this game sensor to track people, and then there's a something called a software-defined radio, which is a little dongle that plugs in the side of your computer and is multi-band. You know, shortwave radio and CB radio, and it actually can transmit and receive, which you can control that all from your computer. And so my scheme was, I'm going to connect this Xbox thing, track people, a dancer's movement or somebody standing in front of the movement, and use that to control the sound of the radio. So, I mean, a lot of folks have used radio in sound constructions, you know, John Cage, and everybody's done that. But just tuning the knobs is kind of limited. And it's hard to get kind of fine-grained control of the sound that way. So
you have to have the right radio from the right era.
yeah. You know, and if you want to do the John Cage piece, you've got to get a Cecil Carlson from 1943, not 44, because they changed the circuit. Right. I don't know. A lot of what I do electronically is not so much the sound. Sound sources, but ways of controlling them, because keyboards are basically rows of buttons, right? You press down, maybe even harder or softer, but basically you press on buttons and sound comes out. and that's very limited. And you get something like a theremin, which is sitting behind you, you know, and then you can wave your arms, which is aesthetically much more interesting.
Especially on the radio.
Especially waving your arms on the radio. That's our theme.
That's a good name for a radio show.
Yeah.
Arms akimbo, I guess.
I would do that. But so there's a lot of folks who are trying to figure out more expressive ways to control electronics. A lot of which involves
so this is like a full body theremin.
This would be like worse than that. Yeah.
The Xbox. Yeah. How many sensors do they have, like for different parts of your body? Like
it puts out about 50 data points. It'll track each of your five fingers
and whether they're 16. Yeah, 50,
whether they're flat. You know, with the wrists, your elbows, your shoulder, knee bone, it's connected. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm doing the math. If they can do that now, 10 years from now, what is the security and hidden camera capabilities all around the world going to be? You know, you go through an airport, they're going to have these things set up everywhere you walk.
Yep.
Picking up all your body movements, and there's going to be certain like suspicious body movements that are programmed into the computer
that's here.
You're already doing that.
Yeah.
You just can't hack into it yet on your week at Wave Farm.
Well, I can't talk about it. We can do it. So that was my project. Was trying to control radios with dancers' movements.
And so with dancers, that's where I was going. That's your end point or your start point, I guess, depending on your point of view, is the dancers. So they would dance, I guess, right?
Or move in one way or another.
Because you could get gymnasts too, and they could do
gym
moves, and that could be some sort of different kind of symphony.
Once you get this contraption working, which I'm about halfway there now, then there's a whole, really the more interesting kind of part is how to map the information that you can garner from that imagery, and what do you actually change about the sound, right? So you can change the tuning, you can change the volume, which is kind of like frequency and pitch in sound controls. But then there's all sorts of other kind of finer tuning, gradations of control you can do on radios. You can change the bandwidth. You can change the modulation types from like AM to FM to single sideband. You know, there's all these things. So you could have, if their arms up, then demodulate it in this way. If their arms down, demodulate.
So it would sound like an AM radio if you do this, but it would sound like a CB radio if you do this.
He just scratched his ankle for CB. I'm not sure that's the. I think it's more like this, Bubba. Scrubbing your ankle, you know, you scratch your belly for the CB. Yeah, I did get a CB tuning thing to work. The camera wasn't working, but I got a distance sensor, so I can change the channels on a CB radio by moving to closer or farther away from the sensor. So
yeah, you got that hooked up. We usually have our CB hooked up, and you don't get too much because there's a interstate about 20 miles that way. So you get if you can bump the you know if you can get that in, you get steady. Yeah. Steady traffic that goes past quickly.
Right. Yes. 17 and 19, I think, are the channels north, south, and east, west truckers.
Yeah.
They're all organized about this now. It's not like
not the like the 70s.
No.
They're not writing songs about them anymore.
Damn it. Convoy. That's what I was working on, and so when some of that stuff wasn't working quite as well as I wanted to, I said, well, let's jump the gun a little bit and manually tune the radio, the software-defined radio, and explore that a little more, and then try to turn that into a composition. So that's the CD that I handed to you before I came in here. If you wanted to.
Oh, let's play that now then.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, does that have a name?
Wave Farm Sketch Number 1. I'll work on that.
We're terrible. With Bob Drake, the current Wave Farm artist in residence, and that was a piece he worked on this week?
This afternoon.
Just now?
Still warm out of the CD burner, I'm telling you. So that's some of that manipulation of the radio sounds is what I'm interested in kind of enabling folks to do live by, you know, with this this interface contraption, this dancing, you know, this motion sensor.
And is this square dancing, so you get some good square waves, or is this more of a line dance? Or is it more of a?
It's a terrible story. I used to play banjo in a contra dance band, and we killed a guy. He keeled over, so I had to quit. I don't do square dance music anymore. we used to joke. We said, that's sad. We can play longer and you can dance. It turned out to be true.
Well, I didn't think this story was going to go that way.
I didn't think we'd talk about square dancing.
Do you have a? Is it open interpretive dance, or what kind of dance do you imagine? I imagine that you imagine some sort of dance in your head already.
I think that probably quick movements would be pretty erratic sounding, which some people might want, but when I was making those changes manually were very slow over time, so probably more of a butoh dance kind of a vibe in my mind's eye, but I don't know any butoh dancers. Maybe I'll have to learn that.
But dancing implies that it's not necessarily true, but that the dancer is like listening to music and responding to music. I mean, you don't have to respond to music, but in this case, it's the exact opposite, right? There's no.
Well, it would be a collaboration, so that most of the technology stuff that I build has a lot of indeterminacy built into it. So it winds up being a collaboration between me and the machine. So I know in general, if I turn this knob, that it'll steer in this general direction. But I often can't play the same note every time by replicating some previously known set of knob settings, right? So this would be a similar thing. The dancer would be listening. Would have know what their motions would do to the contraption, but you certainly can't know what's coming in over the airwaves at any given point. So you might say, well, if I do this, it's going to raise the volume, which it will, or if I do this, it will change the it'll raise the frequency, you know, up a couple kilohertz, which it might. But you don't know what's going to be 2 kilohertz above where you're tuned, so it winds up being an improvisation is like that, right? I mean, if I'm improvising with other musicians, I don't know what they're going to do. They can respond to me, and I can respond to them. There are some fairly well established patterns of trying to. When you collaborate with somebody, try to match what they're doing, or try to contrast with what they're doing, or try to blow what they're doing up. You know, but you can't say, well, this is going to be the outcome. You know, it's always an experiment, and if the folks you're playing with are any good, it's always unexpected. Or if you're any good, you won't do the expected thing every time.
And it's basically a gesture to playing the saxophone or playing the drums is a gesture in the way that the dancers would be in your end result.
Right. Yeah. So gesture is really, really compelling in a performance context, right? One of the complaints about some kinds of computer music, say laptop-based computer music, is there's a guy hunched over a laptop, and there's sound coming out, but you don't know what they're doing, you know, because there's no connection for you as an audience between a person's action and the sound that's coming out. If I'm watching a guitarist, I can see their hands moving, and I can be, as a guitarist, I want to see their hands because I want to see how they're doing what they're doing.
But if you're watching a piano player, depending on where you're sitting, you might see a whole pantomime going on.
Correct. Especially if it's a player piano.
That's a whole nother gesture.
A whole nother technology. So I've found a piano store in Cleveland, the old time piano store, and I went to get a piano to wreck from them and started talking to them. They were restoring this player piano, and I started talking about player pianos and this museum in Pennsylvania that has player pianos. And he looked at me and says, they don't have crap. Let me show you. And he took me to the back room, and he has this whole warehouse of restored mechanical musical instruments, music boxes and circus organs and steam calliopes and things, and they all work.
Where is this?
This is in Cleveland.
In Cleveland.
In like one of the worst neighborhoods.
Somebody told me about like some place in Maine like this that was closing or something. But
there's a couple museums. The one I knew about was in DeBents, Pennsylvania. It's near the Drake Oil Well. And it's a decrepit town, and some farmer really liked those machines and collected a bunch of them. Then he died and gave them to the town. Now they're in a museum. But
and it's the people who stop at the Drake Oil Well's second stop, if they're
third,
going
third stop.
Third
it's
stop.
Falling Water is the second stop.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. How long? That's a long drive. 6 hours, 7 hours. It's from Cleveland. It's not that bad.
I might stop there on the way back. Halfway there.
We often ask people if do you have an early first memory of radio, or did you have some interaction with radio when you were younger at any time, and any sort of radio, you know, like
did
radio plays in front of the baby monitor when you were one or something?
Did that? We had my first had a tape recorder, and my sister remembers performances from WBOB. I think it was about 8, where I would
that
record
was your station.
Yeah, where I would record radio dramas, or you know, me farting, or I don't know what I would record. But actually, the one I remember though, when it first came to mind when you talked about that, I had a paper routes when I was 10, 11, 12. I don't think they let kids do that anymore. But
do they have newspapers now?
maybe not. Not everywhere. But, we would, so I'd be out on this delivering papers at 4 and 5 in the morning. And it was a little, I was pretty young, and it was a little dark and a little scary. So I had a transistor radio that I strapped onto the bicycle handlebars. And
facing you or facing out?
Facing out.
With the speaker facing out.
Yeah. And it was a CKLW, which is a station out of Detroit, and they played a lot of Motown and some great music. It was great. Radios were my friend from early on. And we had a pirate radio station and AM radio station when I was in junior high school.
The high school did itself?
No, we were in junior. No, we were Yahoos by then. We were outlaw. Self-styled outlaws. Yeah. It's actually some folks that were kind of SDS era radicals.
And how did you do an AM radio, because AM is a bigger wave and it's a little more difficult.
The transmitter was an old Navy.
It was an old Navy tube box,
and it wasn't designed for that exactly that frequency, so you had to change the coil a little bit.
The first radio station I was involved with in Tampa, we had some guy that was an ex-Navy person, and he made an old Navy into an FM transmitter.
Yeah. Biggest problem was the antenna, though, because it was, you know, it had to be really large.
Right, because it's a giant wave. Yeah,
it's like halfway, but it was 80 feet long or something.
I think we have an AM transmitter in the truck. I think the wave is 380 altogether, and it's the antenna is like a 1/8 or something.
Yeah, you do a quarter like wave. And so that was, we were always worried about getting busted because the antenna was fixed and kind of obvious. I think we had it up in somebody's attic at one point. It worked okay.
I can't remember. Is there an FCC office in Cleveland? Or was there? Because there's not now.
I don't know about any FCC.
I think maybe in Detroit or Chicago there was an office. That was probably the office that was dealing with Chicago.
No, they would have come after us more for use that as an excuse. We were not friends of the establishment at that point.
So they would have called whoever was upset at you would have called the FCC as a way to solve other problems.
Yes.
Of theirs.
Yeah. always problems.
What was the station called?
I cannot remember that. I cannot remember.
What era? What years is this?
So it would have been like 70.
1970.
72.
Oh, so this is back in. Steal This Book had just come out with this Steal This Radio chapter, written by a group that lived about 20 miles that way.
Okay,
the Video Freaks. They paid for their television transmitter with the money Abby Hoffman gave them for doing the radio pirate radio chapter in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they took a lot. CBS was like hired them to be the hip show, the hippie show, and then they made this show that CBS said there's no way we're ever going to use. But I think they got some equipment out of that too.
Nice.
But that's the connection there.
We had a shout out to libraries at the time. I had a public librarian who made it a point to get me a copy of Steal This Book and Abby Hoffman and Whole Earth Catalog and all this hippie stuff back in the day. Definitely a strong influence. I think a lot about mentors, people that have kind of helped me out at various points, and he was definitely one of them.
I was thrifting in Florida and we got to this crazy like Christian warehouse thrift store, like just junk. It was this giant warehouse, Christian, weird, and we were going through stuff and there was like nothing there at all, but Steal This Book was there. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, mm-hmm, bringing it to the counter, I was like worried, well, are they going to actually let me buy this? You know, because it's this weird Christian, the vibe is definitely like, if they see this book, they're going to take it.
Take it and burn it?
Yes.
And pollute the...
But instead, they gave it to me for free.
Okay.
They didn't charge me for it.
Get this abomination out of here. It's great.
So you got yours from the library?
Yeah.
And so did you guys use that chapter
No, another one of my mentors was a guy who was a small college in Berea, where I grew up, which is just outside of Cleveland, who was a machinist and an engineer. And he worked part-time in the evenings at the college physics department. And a couple of us used to hang out there, and he taught us how to solder. We built like Heath kits, and he helped anybody do anything, basically. And so I think he helped us with that transmitter.
And the antenna too, because the antenna is the.
I'm not sure we ever did the antenna right. it was a big piece of copper with insulation on it.
So how successful were you? How far did you? Because AM can boom if you're doing everything right.
Yeah, we weren't doing everything. A couple miles. You could pick it up through most of the town.
More on a cloudy day? Did it help when it was cloudy? No?
Don't remember. This was a long time ago. Yeah.
So the clouds were all different then. They weren't as full of potassium as they are now, or whatever it is. Yeah. And so you never got caught?
Nope.
And how long did that...
It was probably about a year. Kind of had to find different parents' attics to hide out in and stuff, but it was pretty much a shoestring.
Did the parents eventually find out what was going on, or did they never really catch on?
The parents didn't care as much about things back then, in my experience.
You were playing with electronics, as far as they were concerned. That seemed like a good thing.
I'm not even sure they
knew about that.
They're like, I don't know. What's he doing? Is he not burning the house down? That's good.
And did the town in general know?
No, it was just it was for friends and family. We're friends. Yeah, so there was a bunch of hippies in town. They had a food co-op and all of the things the hippies do, and so we were all.
I don't know as much about 70s pirate radio, but did every major city basically have a pirate radio station?
I don't know that either. I was quite young.
I know
it was a long time ago.
I know like the history more from the 80s kind of onward in terms, but I don't really know. I know in the 70s, mostly what I know about is the Italian scene was really crazy. They didn't have rules and no FCC for a period in the 70s, and it was kind of anything goes, and it all was this magical wonderland of no regulation.
Yeah. What I remember was if you didn't step on anybody else's channel, then nobody really cared.
Well, that's,
but that's what I remember.
And that's what it is now. I mean, basically, we've always told people the only way you're going to really get caught is what you said, that's the most likely. A broadcaster who's licensed, you're on their frequency, frequency.
He tried to claw
claw
the microphone there with the air quotes.
So that's the most likely that you're going to come out. And when we were pirates in Brooklyn, we got visits a couple times. I don't think we ever, we could have had an FCC visit, but I don't think we did. But we definitely had visits from other pirates who were mad that we were using their frequency.
Their stolen frequency. Appropriated frequency.
Because we use several transmitters in many frequencies, and like if we're going here and there, so there's always somebody that's upset, no matter what.
If you step on somebody's toes,
Does Cleveland have enough static spots in between for pirate stations?
Probably low power stuff. No, it's actually FM is pretty stacked.
And is it good? What do you think of radio in Cleveland?
Cleveland has the best college radio scene in the country, as far as I know. We've got four strong stations that do alternative programming, and another one or two that kind of are radio club style things. But WREW at Case and WCSB, where I was at Cleveland State, just do out up there with FMU and yourselves. It's just really high quality, high energy folks, and a long tradition of doing alternative radio there. Mainstream radio, up the dial from that, I don't know. We've got a longstanding classical station at the other end of the dial that's been around forever. And then in between there, it's a wasteland. I don't know about it.
And there's no like crazy AM talk station that's the best in the world, or there's not here, so I don't know.
I don't know.
They're mostly plugged in from LA and.
It's a bunch of Chicago stuff I don't know about. Yeah, you can only know so much.
You're listening to the static in between the stations more, right? That's what you were saying?
A friend of mine gave me his new cassette, and I put it in a cassette player and turned it on and listened to it for about 15 minutes. I was really digging it. And then I realized that it was not the cassette. I had pushed the radio button. It was like, sorry, Chris.
So, should we play something from your? Is this the failure record? What is it?
Failure cake. Yeah, actually, I've got the liner notes. I wanted to read the liner notes because I've never gotten a chance to read them. And they're not on the record,
No one's had the chance to read them.
Right. So you could play the record underneath this.
And so you get both of them at the same time.
Yeah. Okay,
there we go.
Is that the same one? Yeah, I fail a lot. That's what happens. Okay, you know how it is. Sometimes you try and it just crumples or fractures or fails or smears or shatters or shorts out or just fails. Over and over. And there you are. Yeah, fine. So then sometimes you gather up that broken thing, that pile of disappointment, gather it up in your arms and dump it in a bowl and shake it and stir it and mix it up and make it into a cake. Nice big failure cake. Bake it up and let it cool, icing, maybe add a few sprinkles. You know, failure cake. So now you cut yourself a big old slice of that failure cake that you worked so hard on. You fork it in your mouth. Failure cake. Big old smile on your face and you start chewing on that cake with gusto. Chew, 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 yum. Smacking your lips. It's cake after all. You like cake. Everybody likes cake. Yes, sir. Munching on that failure cake. It's moving from one side of your mouth to the other as it breaks down and mixes with your saliva and releases complex, deeper flavor. Its true essence, like salt and bile and rancid and etched aluminum. But keep working it. It's cake, damn it. You made it and you're going to eat it. Eat the whole damn thing like some masochist monk practicing mindfulness by chewing one bite of rice 10,000 times. Come on now, who are you kidding? What are you trying to prove? You don't have to do this thing. Put it down. Spit it out. Throw it away. Dig a hole in the backyard and bury it. Put it in a bag with a brick and heave it onto the lake. F it. Give it up. It's a damn failure cake, for crying out loud. What are you thinking?
You're listening to the radio WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. Thank you.
Listening to the radio with Bob Drake. What did we just hear, Bob?
That was failure number 31.
You can't keep track of them all?
There's a lot of them. Goes up to 263 on this record. But
well, there's more failure started underneath this. Yeah. We can talk over failure, I guess, right? Is that all right?
That's what I always do.
What did you figure out about radio or about whatever this week that through failure or through success or whatever?
Oh, I learned a lot about the inner workings of the software-defined radio, hardware and software. My day job is with computers. I kind of don't usually go there very much for music stuff. But so I was diving into C programming and stuff, trying to reverse engineer what was going on inside there. So I learned a lot about that. I spent a lot of time in the great library downstairs. There's a big long line of stuff.
Yeah, what were you nosing through?
Actually, I looked at a lot of stuff on video broadcast. That's something that I've been playing with more. I just put out a kind of a hacky glitch printed circuit board that takes analog video and messes with it. And have been teaching workshops on that with at CIA and around town. Folks like getting that's kind of a new thing is video synthesis. So read a bunch of stuff there, found a couple of good friends like with articles in there. I didn't realize that they had done that. They're now doing audio synthesizers, but folks that I played with, and I said, oh, Richard Brewster, you used to be at Experimental Video. Wow. You helped build the first Wobulator. Wow. I didn't know that. I said, oh, yeah. That was a while ago. So a lot of that. The thing I want to learn more about is antennas. They've always seemed kind of mystical to me.
Receiving or transmitting?
Mostly receiving. But they all... we do work for a commercial place that does antenna hardware installations, and they're always talking about... I don't know, helical polarization and stuff that I don't know anything about. I know a lot about analog and audio frequency electronics, but not much about RF frequency. So that's something I'll be digging into more. I like the idea of feedback. So I'm thinking about tiny transmitters feeding back to each other on each other. Kind of installations based around that.
Isn't that talk radio?
Yeah.
That's sort of a metaphorical joke.
Yeah. Can you hear the echo? I can hear the echo. Can you hear it? Yes, I can hear it.
Rush Limbaugh, I'm actually a huge old Rush Limbaugh fan back in the day. He was the master of silence. He basically uses the pregnant pause. He doesn't anymore. All his skills are atrophied, and he's a pill-popping crazy head. I mean, he was always crazy in terms of his political views, but he was a master of using silence and the pregnant pause, and he set us up for all kinds of things that are going on now.
He had some skills as a broadcaster.
Yeah, as a broadcaster, yeah. Do you have any other favorite weird old were there classic Cleveland radio show hosts over the years?
Well, we had Goulardi, who was, but TV. Actually, so growing up, I was never into commercial sports, but about 25, 30 years ago, the Cleveland Indians were so bad, so terrible, they couldn't win a game to save their life. And there's a radio broadcaster, Herb Score, who was the most enthusiastic Indians fan of all. And he would be, I started listening to him broadcast these games, kind of perverse, just to hear him rave about these folks that you could not possibly reasonably rave about. And he was brilliant at it. You know, those are some kind of ball players. You know, it's like, I don't know what, you know, like that was a good thing. So I started listening to baseball. I became a baseball fan. And then when they got good, it was like, what's wrong with this picture?
They probably replaced him too then, right?
No, he died. Right. Yeah. He was brilliant. But skills on the mic. You know, even if you don't like the message, you can kind of appreciate folks being good at their vocation. Still hate Rush Limbaugh, though. Sorry.
So our hour has come to an end with Bob Drake. Is there anything we forgot to bring up?
No.
Have you you starting to get transmissions in your teeth after being here a week, or anything other kind of changes?
I could stay another week. This is really wonderful what you got going on here. It's quite a thing.
All right. Well, we've been glad to host your failures this week from Bob Drake.